Fisher Body Historical Team interview. Today is February 6, 2006. It's approximately 11:10 a.m. We are UAW Local 602 Frank Dreyer Greenhouse. First, we'll introduce the team.
Earl Nicholson.
Cheryl McQuay.
Jerry Smith.
John Fedewa.
Gary Judy.
And Marilyn Coulter. Today, we're here with Milton Van. Milton, could you please say and spell your name for us, please?
Okay, my name is Milton J. Van. That's M-I-L-T-O-N, J as in Jerome, and last name Van, V as in Victor, V-A-N-N.
Could you please give us your address?
I live at 201 North Hagedorn, East Lansing, Michigan, 48823.
Are you married?
Yes, 35 years.
And do you have children?
Two boys.
All right. Now, where were you born?
Detroit.
Detroit. Were you also raised in Detroit?
Yes.
Okay. And your education?
BS in Social Science from Michigan State, 1971.
And were you ever in the military?
Air Force.
Oh, and how long were you there?
4 years.
And what did your parents do?
My father worked in a factory, or working class people. It was a company called Motor Products, and they went out of business in their early 50s, and he never went back to work. I think they actually have a Motor Products in Owosso or somewhere, but I don't know if it's the same company.
Mm. So what did you do before you hired him?
I was a student at Michigan State.
So you were a student at Michigan State, and you were studying your social science?
My first one was MedTech.
Oh, it's a MedTech. So, you're at Michigan State University. You come from a... Your father was a factory worker.
Right.
What brought you into Fisher Body?
Well, after I had quit school in 66, and I came back here in 67, and this was the really only place that had, was doing hiring. Had any real substantial jobs, and plus I come from Detroit, where just about all my family were auto workers, Chrysler primarily.
So, did you know anything about Fisher Body before you came in?
No, I didn't. Mm-hmm. I remember one summer professor was going to get me a job here, but I didn't know couldn't see, so that fell through. But I had no idea about Fisher Body or. I didn't know anything about Lansing other than it was the state capital.
Yeah. What did you think about factory workers prior to coming in here, since you came from the automotive town of Detroit?
Well, I didn't have any opinion per se. I know that they were, they were hardworking people because I grew up under that.
Okay. So, when did you hire into Fisher Body?
10/9/67.
So, do you remember how that came about? How was your employment? Did you come to the plant? Did you stand in line?
Yeah, actually, I came to the plant. I was expecting long lines like in Detroit, and I got here one morning. There was nobody here, this was during the Vietnam era, and I guess they were really had difficulty actually getting people to work. I mean, they would advertise in the newspaper, get your relatives or whoever to come to work at Fisher Body. But I actually stood in line out in Detroit. Contrast with that Detroit, even under good times, I mean, there would be blocks and blocks of people standing in line for factory jobs, because one time I did out there in Dodge, Maine, in Hamtramck. But I was totally shocked. There was nobody in line.
So you just walked right in?
Just walked right in and signed up. And I guess a few days later, I was working.
So do you remember what job you did and what shift?
I worked night shifts, and my first job primarily was truck rovers, and I stayed on truck rovers for about 5 years. And I worked with this lady named Hazel Meredith. I'll never forget Hazel. It was one of the few women who actually worked in the soft trim department, that they called it at the time. Most of the women were working in the cushion room.
Can you please explain the soft trim and cushion room for us, please?
Well, the cushion room is where they actually built the seats, and I guess they made a distinction between soft and hard trim. Soft trim, I guess, is, we were just
So that was more or less the soft trim. Was that more like the interior stuff that people would see, like armrest and?
Or was that? Wait a minute. Maybe we were in hardware. Maybe I get confused. That was hardware. I think soft trim was up in 3X somewhere, and they actually put in the seats and stuff. And I was in hardware. That's right. And you know, we did stuff like trunk rubbers, moldings. You know, just the basic building up to the body after they come out of the paint department.
Covering up all those sharp metal edges.
Right. So I used to spray detonators, fiberglass detonators, and, you know, we put all that stuff in before.
You sprayed
fiberglass detonators.
And that's
for soundproofing.
Oh, okay, for soundproofing.
Right.
And that would go on the floor, on the
walls? Yeah, inside the, right.
Oh, okay. So,
But primarily, I worked trunk rubbers, and that was my first introduction to, you know, work, real work.
So what did you think about that when you walked and you saw the inside of that plant and you were taken to your job? Do you remember that process?
Right. Well, it was kind of, you know, you feel like you were first day in a strange school, and you didn't know anybody, and it was overwhelming. It was a lot of people. You didn't know anybody, and you had to orient yourself to it.
So was there anybody who took you under their wing, or who trained you?
No, not really. The only person I remember really at the time was Supervisor Dick Budd. It was my first supervisor. And but, you know, once I got on the job, actually learned the job, you more or less stayed there. And I used to, of course, everybody hated it because you... First time, you know, actually doing production and the monotony and the be able to endure that physical work to make the adaptation to the physical work lifestyle.
How was that for you, coming from Michigan State, being a student, and then working on the assembly line?
Right. Well, it wasn't what I expected, you know. I escaped Detroit just so I could get away from the auto industry and end up in the auto industry in Lansing.
Yeah, so a little bit of irony there. Right? So, how old were you when you hired him?
I was 22 years old.
You were 22. So at 22, when you came in and you hired in, were there any kind of new hire initiations or pranks or anything that were played on you?
No, I don't remember. We had a brief orientation, but, you know, people were pretty nice. Nice people.
So your first day was a pretty good day?
Oh, yeah. You know, I expect things to be, you know, because you get the high school mode, you think, you know, you had a lot of fear and stuff, but, you know, you didn't realize these were adults, they weren't children.
Mm-hmm.
And they were nice people in Lansing.
And now, did you say this was the day shift that you hired in on?
Night shift.
You hired in on night shift. So, now you said that Hazel Meredith... Was she like the only woman around, or was she?
No, she wasn't the only one, but they only had just a few women in the trim department at the time. And I think I talked to you before, so you said had to give her extra time to go to the bathroom because the bathroom was downstairs on the main floor, and we were all upstairs. Both lines were upstairs at the time. That's before we had the new part built in the 80s.
Okay, and so you said they had both lines, so they ran two car lines
upstairs, right? So, and it's amazing that they had over 5,000 people, and that, you know, we had didn't have a clue how compact that we were in there, but they had over 5,000 people in that plant, and like I said, that's before they built the new, you know, the downstairs, you know, assembly line.
Do you remember how many products you built back then?
We built, I think at one time, we had over about 30 different car styles.
And that was colors and...
Colors, station wagons, police cars, two doors, four doors, you name it. I think it was pretty close to 30 different model cars we built in that plant.
Oh, that was very interesting. So, were there many other African Americans there?
Not very many. That was one shocking thing about it, because usually, generally in our industry, you'd think there'd be a lot of Black Americans in the production, but it was different here in Lansing. It was predominantly white, you know, and I was in your work group, and it'd be 30, 40 people, you know, maybe the only Black in there.
What about Latinos?
Just a handful. And this is the first time I ever really come in contact with Latinos and the American Indians.
Really? And how was that for you?
That was interesting, especially with American Indians. I know George Roy, who's probably still working, he came from Manitoulin Island in Canada. I think it was about four or five guys who came from Manitoulin Island. And this is the first contact I had with Native Americans or Native Canadians or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the environment like for the African Americans and the Hispanics and the women?
I didn't, you know, it was such few. I don't think there was, I don't remember any conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Very few. In 1967, that's pretty great. So what did you think of the people on the plane?
Well, they were good people. I mean, they were hardworking people. Everybody came and did their job. You know, it's a new lifestyle to adapt to. And that's the hard part, is being able to adapt to a new lifestyle. And as time go on, you really gain more respect, because then you really understand the big picture. There's no typical factory worker per se. You know, it's a diversity of people, diversity of skills, diversity of education, diversity of everything. And I don't mean racial diversity, it's just diversity of people.
Did you find a lot of people like yourself that had come from college and was working in the plant for whatever reasons?
Well, in the sense that, like I said, there's no typical factory mm-hmm. workers. Everybody kind of, you could always sell your labor regardless. I mean, we had lawyers, you know, Jack Phillips, he actually retired out of here, and he was a lawyer. We had one guy from Leslie was a lawyer. We had all kinds of people.
Oh, that's great.
Now, you said you hired in on trim. Did you always stay in the trim shop, or did you go in body or paint or anything?
I've always stayed in trim. And then I went later on to QC, but still always in trim.
Oh, this is Jerry Smith.
Mostly, very seldom, I've maybe once or twice worked on the M system or B system. I've always worked on the A system or C system.
Now, Mel, you said that you worked at nights. Did you always work on night shift? Did you ever work days?
I only worked days out of my almost 37 years, 36.7 to be exact. I may worked a year and a half on days.
Only a year and a half? Now, one would think that.
That's on three different occasions.
One would think the days would be a preferred shift. Were there many people you preferred nights? And
yeah, you know, it's it was. We had our own special. You know, was one thing about the night shift, I always felt special about it, because, you know, we had people who were permanent night shifters. I mean, we just enjoyed being on nights where everybody else wanted to go to days. It was never an issue. I preferred nights. And even when I went to days, I really had a difficult time. I had to get back to nights. I did everything in my power to get back to nights. My world was really turned upside down when I went to day shift.
Yeah. Was there anything that you noticed that was different between the plant culture on nights versus days?
I wasn't on days long enough, but see, the night shift was a little bit more vibrant. You had probably younger people. I think it was more cohesive on the night shift from my point of view. Maybe it's, you know, I may be wrong about that, but I don't know. Nights was special, you know, to me. I'm sure people argue that the day shift was the same thing for them, but like I said, we had our own permanent people who've been on nights for years and who wouldn't prefer it any other way.
So, can you tell me, how long did you do trunk rubbers, or did you do that for a long
time? I did trunk rubbers for about 5 years.
For 5 years? So, 5 years, did you keep the same partner? Did you do that by yourself?
Oh, I had a different partner after, I think Hazel ended up retiring, and then we had, you know, different partners and stuff.
Oh, so after 5 years, then where'd you go?
And I think I did detonators, start spraying fiberglass detonators. Then one time I went to windshield clips, and then John Powers, who was our general foreman, he asked me, he offered the door glass job for me, and that was a really good job. And I don't know if anybody mentioned John Powers, who was our general foreman, who always had a reputation for being hard-nosed, but one thing, looking back in retrospect, John Powers was pretty fair, but he was like a despot, but if you did a good job, he would reward you.
How would he reward you?
Well, like I said, with the job, I mean, he didn't have to do that. And I remember one time Willie Fuller was wanted to go to State Police Academy, and nobody would give him an educational leave. And John Powers personally went down to Jerry Brooks and demanded that Willie get an educational leave. And John Powers, here's a guy who had a reputation actually for firing his own kid in the place. He had a reputation, a hell of a reputation. And you know,
he actually fired his own kid.
So you didn't mess around with Powers, but you know, it was you know, and like I said, he was hard nosed, but looking back, you know, it's, you know, you kinda laugh because that's the way the culture was back then. And that's the way it was, you know. We knew our limits.
So everyone knew their limits.
They should definitely knew their limits.
Now, you said that you worked on the trunk rubbers and you worked with fiberglass. Was there any kind of special equipment that you had to wear when you were working with this stuff?
Well, at the time, you know, we didn't have all the safety precautions. Even to this day, sometimes I worry about breathing fiber. I think I spent a year on that job and, you know, spraying that stuff. And then fiberglass, I think, has been known to be a carcinogen. But there was never any, you know, mask or anything. They didn't push safety back in those days.
Do you kind of remember when safety became an issue?
Well, at one point in time, actually, we made it an issue because when we were doing trunk rubbers and some of this was sealant, and we wanted information about it. And this is before the union or management really got into it, and we made it an issue, and we had a difficult time trying to get information about, you know, what we were actually working with. And you know, because you taught the class about you know, the safety in the workplace, but that information wasn't available. And then when they did come with the information, they would just give you just a general description, like they might say, "Well, it's aromatic carbohydrate, I can't pronounce the word right now. Anyway, which really means that it smells, but they didn't tell you what compounds and stuff you were actually working with. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that was a big change, so you, at least you know exactly the chemicals you were working with. And one time when we were building door glass, they came to the process where they would bake at least the rear glass into this polyvinyl, well, the stuff was really basically polyvinyl chloride, which is a known carcinogen, and they would actually blow that out into the shop, and we raised holy hell about that. And finally, they were forced to vent the stuff into the atmosphere. They had to go to the city and get permission, but, you know, we forced them. And this is all before, you know, these issues, became an issue about health and safety, that we were pushing this stuff ourselves.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent. So,
because some of us, but what people got to understand is that when I mentioned diversity, you had a diversity of education, you had a diversity of skills, and that when these issues came up, there was always somebody in the plant who had some expertise. I mean, I've had chemistry before. You know, whether a guy could read or write, he might be a mechanical genius. You had all these people with all these skills, and they could always step forward and complete the stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's good. So you all were a tight-knit group also, I take it? If you all were able to come together like that, were you a tight-knit group?
Oh, yeah. But we had our own, you know, like in glass, you know, it was a special group in and of itself. And I actually people became your family in there. I mean, you saw them more than you saw your own spouse.
You saw them more, and you said they became your family.
They became your family, your de facto family. They were your family while you spent 8, 9, 10 hours a night in the shop.
So back then, that was like the longest machine you would have to work was 10 hours?
Yeah, well, actually, when I first hired in there, we were doing 10.3 hours every, not right away, but later on, we would do 10.3 hours every night.
No, this is just 5 days a week? Or
5 days, and then if we worked Saturday, we probably worked 6 hours on Saturday. And it was pretty hard, you know, because you can imagine working 5 hours and then working another five and then 3/10 more. That really got out of hand. At one point, it got so bad that people in the body shop were just about ready to revolt. Really? So it was extremely hard.
Because you're working a lot of time. Now, you said that what made the glass department special? You said that they were really tight-knit group. What makes the glass department such a tight-knit group? What do you think about that?
Because I guess we had, you know, unique jobs. And the genius of the people is that we were always able to organize our work. You know, whatever the task was, we would get together, they talk about the stuff now, but we could always figure out how to do our job and do it efficiently and squeeze some time out for ourselves.
Oh, so how much time would you be able to squeeze out for yourself?
I don't know. We'd probably spend maybe extra 40 or maybe an hour a night just for ourselves because we organize the work. I mean, we would have one person, at one point we had four people on both sides. We had three people two people building glass, front door glass, one building rear door glass, and the one on the line just installing. And then we would build so much glass up towards the end of the night, we just had so much glass on the floor, we just installed it and everybody could relax.
So what did you have to do when you say you built glass? What did you have to do to build glass?
To build glass is to, especially when we had the cutlass, you have to put fasteners and can't really describe it, where you could actually slide down what they call the door channels. You had to build it. You just couldn't put the glass in. So you have to have fasteners where the glass could fixate itself inside so you can roll it up and down. And sometimes that was really extensive process, but they, as time went on, they made it simpler and simpler and used less and less people. But when we were building the cutlass, that was a big build-up. That's a big job.
So you were in the door glass area where you did the side glass, not the windshield or back glass?
Right. Oh. No, I never did windshield or back glass, just door, okay. Side glass.
So were those easy to install? Did you get cut or anything like that, messing with glass?
Oh, yeah. It was every once in a while one would explode on you, but... Just like everything else in there, I don't care how difficult the jobs were, you do this stuff every day. I mean, you really got to get it. You could do it in your sleep. I mean, the most complex jobs became easy.
Earl Nicholson, why don't you take a moment and explain what Glass Group is? I think a lot of people, what are groups?
Well, we had specialized groups at the time, and later on they changed that. But, of course, we actually got... pay a little bit more, maybe 7 cents more an hour, but Glass Group, I think, really consists of side glass, back glass, and windshield. And they, like I said, they were specialized groups, and they required a little bit more skills. I remember before we had robots, when guys used to run the beads on the back glass and the windshield, they did that by hand, and that took a lot of skill, because they had to be right. Right now they do it with robots, but people actually did it by hand. And even after one time they installed, they had an $80,000 machine to do that, and it really, really failed. That was a lot of money back then for them. But, we always end up outworking the machines. And people are really good, really skillful.
How long did you work in the glass department?
I think I spent about, that's the longest area I ever worked in. I think I spent about at least 11 years just building door glass. It was a good job. It was one of the better jobs.
Did you I know you said you were like a family. Did any of those family friendships extend outside the plant?
Oh, yeah. We would, it's guys who I met up in from Vesterburg and St. Louis area, we would go up there, and it was a totally different world. I never even know those places existed, because I was from Detroit, in Detroit, nothing that really exists outside Detroit, but they had little towns like St. Louis, I never even heard of before. And you really got to, learn about other people's lives, especially for those workers who worked in rural areas, who had small farms, or who were full-time farmers. It was, eye-opening.
What would you say was probably one of the most surprising or interesting things you learned about a coworker?
I don't know so much as I was just amazed by the people's abilities to do so many different things. I remember I had one friend of mine, and I was shocked that he couldn't. I didn't even know he couldn't read or read very little. And I would go over to his house, and he would have a steering column out around 3 o'clock, and about around 6 o'clock, he's driving the car. The guy was really a mechanical genius. You know, he couldn't read, but you had these people with all these abilities, which would totally amaze me, that don't fit the public's eye of, factory workers. They get this monolithic view of what a factory worker is, but really, the diversity of skills would just amaze me. And I'll give you another example. It's another friend of mine, and Jim DeNike, computer genius. And like I mentioned once before, that he was checking our paychecks, and he wrote his programs and found out there was an error in the program from whoever processed our paychecks. Here's a guy on the line who's writing a computer program, and that resulted in about $17,000. In 1 week, we got like four or five extra bucks. It was just in pennies, but over a period of time. But the point is that you had somebody working on the assembly line who could write in machine language programs. I mean, that's the amazing part to me, was that all the skills that people brought to the plant.
Earl Nicholson, you said you made a comment of people's monolithic views of factory workers. Could you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Well, the general public think that, for one thing, they think factory workers are uneducated. And I think at one point we had like over 60 people who had college degrees. I'm sure if you, even just the, the academic level, but the skill level of, guys who would build their own homes or lay their own concrete. People in the university couldn't possibly even do those things, even have those skills. So the idea that factory workers were uneducated or unskillful is just totally incorrect, because you had people with tremendous skills, and they refined those skills. And when they came to the shop, it was always somebody there to execute. Just for example, when we first started using computers in the plant, nobody taught, most of us, we learned on our own. So when the time came and they need people with computer skills, they were out there, they were right on the assembly line. And, and they were, learning how to do graph, they were doing word processing way beyond, anything that we were supposed to know as, as typical factory workers. That's supposed to be an honor I ran, but people made a hobby. It was a hobby for me, computers.
So did these hobbies and these different talents that your coworkers have, were you ever able to utilize those outside the plant?
Oh, my God. Anything I needed to do I didn't know how to do, I used them as a resource, whether I'm installing a dishwasher or anything that I needed to know. And I didn't have any skills. I didn't even know how to hold a motor in my hand, because I never worked before in my life. I mean, actually real work. And you find out that, just like men and women who came from rural areas, they knew how to work. I didn't know how to work. Even though I went to the university, it didn't prepare me to do actually, physical. The physical work. And not only you had to define the work, it's not just doing any repetitious thing, it's being able to organize work efficiently so you could, so it wouldn't really kill you. You had to organize this work yourself. But a lot of people came in, they knew about machinery, they had all these, like I said, they had all these skills that normally society wouldn't, attribute to factory workers, but they had a tremendous amount of skills. I mean, they were repairing cars, building cars, on their own, painting cars. When they come in the plant, they had these skills.
And which, by them coming in with those skills and with that certain work ethic, it sounds like it helped them do what they had to do.
Well, I think, I never worked in another plant before, but I always thought that was with the university, especially with the university here and, and the people who worked in the rural areas. You had a tremendous pool of talent, and I think this is what made Fisher Body so successful.
So you said that we had a lot of talent, you were able to work together, and you were able to build up stock and work away and work together in such a way and do a team and become a team that you were able to get extra time. What types of things did you guys do in there, extra time, to kind of pass that time and get you through your day?
Well, because you know, we would read or visit people, but the, you know, the line was pretty grueling, pretty hard. So, you know, we just really used that time to relax, because it's hard work, you know, and it probably still is. I think it's even harder today than it was back there, because when we were working, we more or less took stock out of boxes and put them on car, but now you take stock and you got to build the stock up and then put it on the cars. It's a lot harder today than it was then.
Can you take us through what a day was like for you back then? How would your day start?
Well, basically, you know, of course we use our punch. We didn't have cards lying. You know, we had to go actually to the time clock and punch in. And I mean, I don't know if I can, in general terms, you know, we just start off, you know, doing our job, working, organizing, figure out who's, like in door glass, figuring out who's going to do what for the day. Normally, we would rotate the jobs, so it made it more easy for everybody. Because we did it, you know, that was our way of working, doing it efficiently. Not necessarily, I mean, we could have did it, you know, the way it was designed, but, you know, human beings don't work that way. They always want to find easier ways to benefit themselves as well as the company. And we worked hard.
Your supervisor didn't care if you switched jobs around and stuff like that?
No, not really. They, you know, as long as we were doing our jobs, sometimes they would take advantage of it. You know, they figure that these guys got extra time. But, see, that was the only trade-off. If we became more efficient and we used our own heads, that sometimes we were penalized by, you know, with more work. So you have to be kind of cautious about that. And it was difficult work, but we always figure out ways of doing it efficiently that benefited everybody, the company as well, as because we were efficient.
So you come in, you punch in, and then you
right, and then we
figure out who's going to do what.
We do our job, and then lunchtime came, and we, you know, we either, you know, you went upstairs to the cafeteria and stood in line. You know, some of you guys don't remember standing in line at the cafeteria, because at that point in time, people didn't go out, run down to McDonald's or all these other places. We actually ate in the cafeteria. We actually had 42-minute lunch breaks, too. And some people were able to go home and come back. And then one year, they decided that why spend extra 12 minutes, you know, which amounts to an extra hour a week. And supposedly, the people voted for half an hour of lunch breaks instead of the 42-minute lunch breaks.
Now, I understand that they had a wagon, and maybe you can explain that for us.
Yeah.
And so you had your 42 minutes plus your extra breaks, or can you explain your
Yeah, we had the wagon. I think the wagons was for 6 minutes, and they would actually stop the line. We were running what they call tag relief. You know, somebody would come and relieve you for your 15 minutes or whatever the time period was, and then come back. But when the wagon came back, they actually would stop the line where you could buy, you know, cakes or cookie or coffee or, you know, all that kind of stuff. Which I always liked the wagon, because it kind of broke up the day. You know, we had something to look forward to. And then one year they decided that, they offered that they would, I'm not sure if they would give us extra time. They tried to put it into these break areas, and then the people voted that down and went back to the wagon, but eventually the wagon was, they eliminate the wagon, but we actually voted that down and kept our wagon as long as we could. And so the argument was always that we were always the only plant. And that's where most of it, everything that we did, we were always the only plant that did this, so, you know, we had to conform.
So was that wagon a little truck that came through with these?
Yeah, it was like a little cart, and the people in the cafeteria, you know, ran the wagons, and we actually would buy this stuff, you know, coffee, donuts, and that kind of stuff.
And it came in the morning and afternoon?
Yeah, in the morning and afternoon.
And so you got the wagon break and one tag break and then lunch?
I think we had two tag breaks during the day, and then maybe one or two. All depends how long we're going. If we went, you know, 10 hours, of course, we're going to get more breaks. I don't recall exactly how that went.
Now, was the cafeteria a centrally located place? Did you have a far way to go?
Yeah, it wasn't bad for trim. I'm sure people in the paint department probably did. I'm not sure. I would assume it was harder for them to get there, but in trim, it was pretty close. But the thing is that back in those days, very few people actually went outside to eat lunch. You know, they would stand in line and and buy their lunch in the cafeteria.
So the managers and employees all eat in the same place?
Well, everything was kind of, the cafeteria is actually segregated. So it was, you know, the workers had their own cafeteria, the management had their own cafeteria. And then when the Japanese, with the competition from Japan, and the management decided that we should all eat together, the same way the parking lot was segregated. We had the managers on one side of the parking lot and the workers on the other side of the parking lot.
Did you think that kept it a kind of us versus them type of deal because you ate separately and you parked separately? How did you feel about that?
Well, yeah, but that's the way things were, you know. And, you know, if we can look in hindsight about that, but have to understand that was the lifestyle, that was the culture, and also remember that, you know, General Motors was very successful at that point in time, so nobody really argued that. And I guess that was one of the benefits of being a supervisor. You had privilege, parking privileges, and you ate in your own special cafeteria.
Well, talking about supervisors, what about supervisors? Can you tell us what was a good supervisor, what was a bad supervisor, and how did supervision change while you were during your time of employment?
Well, as I mentioned before, John Powers was the archetype for the hard-nosed supervisor, general foreman. I think on the M system they had Marshall Dean, which I never really worked for him, but I heard he was kind of really hard-nosed too, and just the way things were done. But most of the supervisors, if you did your job, you didn't have any problems with supervisors. I mean, they would actually, if you were good enough, they would actually tell you you were a good worker. They would reward you in that kind of way, but you did your job, you didn't have any problems with supervisors. I mean, only time, you know, later on as the competition got more intense, when they started putting work on people, then the conflicts kind of started with supervisors. But, you know, in the beginning, you know, you did your job, you didn't have any problems.
So what type of conflicts?
Well, when they had to start organizing work and adding work, you know, like in the last maybe 4 or 5 years, I mean, it's tremendous job cutting, and people had to carry these tremendous burdens of, I mean, they were working harder than they ever worked in their life, and it was extremely hard. It's, you know, emotionally, it was tough, you know, and then the supervisor, you know, they're in the process of adding work, and I'm sure a lot of them didn't like to do it, but, you know, it was done, but, it, you know, that created a lot of problems.
So we had different cars being built. You had two lines going side by side, and then they split. And can you tell us about some of the environmental changes and how they affected the employees during those times?
Well, the biggest change when they built the new park downstairs, and that certainly, I mean, we weren't even aware that we were on top of each other until they built, you know, the new plant downstairs for this. A and C system, but I guess the biggest thing I thought was the health, when they started coming up with the information about chemicals and stuff. I think that helped a great deal. At least you know exactly what you're working with, the chemicals. And I mean, that was a big change, because, you know, I was in there when before they even had electric trucks, and I used to be on the corner when the trucks actually had gasoline lift trucks. And they would turn around and they would spray you with fumes. That's just where it was. And the UAW finally got them to start running electric trucks inside. And that was a huge, huge difference.
Can you tell me, what about the noise level? Was it noisy inside the plant?
Yeah, it was noisy, but you didn't... that's just part of the, you know, lifestyle in there. But, you know, the really funny thing is that when, like in the summertime, the thing that bothered me more was the heat. You know, I don't particularly like working with a lot of heat now. I mean, I can't deal with heat. And it used to be in the out there on Verlinden, where the M system was, and they used to have these windows, and they had them caged up, and it used to be so hot in there, and you would walk over to the windows and you would look out and you feel like you're in prison somewhere, because you could look outside and the grass was always so much greener and people were strolling around, and it seemed like it was just a totally different world outside, because you were so miserable with, you know, because of the, to me, it was the more so the heat that was just bugging me.
So if it was 70 degrees outside, how would you think you'd be inside?
I'd be probably 90 or 95 inside. It was extremely hot. We didn't have all the fans and stuff that we have now. Of course, the place wasn't air conditioned. They couldn't air condition it. The place would be too old. But we didn't have the fans. It's been a lot of environmental changes, you know, you really think about it. It was pretty tough in there.
You talk about the changes that took place. Did you ever participate in any strikes to get any changes? Or
well,
was that
well the
time
only
or?
Strike that we actually ever had, real strike, was in 1970. So, and that was almost, I don't know how many days, it was 59 days or whatever it was. So we actually...
Do you remember what they were striking for?
I'm not sure. It was more for the... I don't know if it was so much for the local, right, you know, changes in the, as far as the local was concerned, but I think it was, you know, the national strike. I don't know what the issues were in 1970.
Was that 30 and out, maybe, or...?
Yeah, it could possibly be. It was major stuff. But I remember, you know, that was a long time.
Did you have to walk the picket line?
Oh, yeah. And actually, we sit in our cars and stuff. And it got kind of cold by November. And it was hard out there. But we actually walked the picket line. And I would never, after all those years, I would think we would have had more strikes. But that was the only real strike. And actually, I got married 2 days before the strike. So.
Do you remember how much the strike pay was back then? How
I
much?
Think it was $50. And actually...
$50 a week?
Yeah. And actually, at that time, we could actually go down and... I think my wife and I, we went and got food stamps. They actually would give you food stamps. Yeah. But, the Republican Party or somebody decided that it was... You know, they were paying for a strike against themselves, and of course the politicians changed that one. But we actually got food stamps that got us through.
That'd have been interesting. Yeah, we had a brand new bride
and
out of work.
Out of work.
A strike the next 2 days.
Speaking of pay, do you remember what you hired in at?
Thanks, Rob. Pay?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was just a little over $3 an hour. I remember at the time bringing home $100, I thought I was rich. And it was so interesting about pay. It's funny you mentioned that. I used to get real nervous every time I got a paycheck, and I couldn't figure out why I was getting nervous about it. And it sort of dawned on me. It was just like, you know, because I was a student at State, it was sort of like getting your exam or something. And I would actually get intensely nervous every time the paychecks were given out. And like I said, it was for the longest. I could never figure out why I was getting so nervous. But, you know, bringing home $100, $125 and 67, that was a lot of money. Mm. That was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money. Can you tell us, Milton, now you stayed on the line and you stayed in glass for a long time, but now you came out as a quality consultant.
Yeah, first I went to, after door glass, I transferred to water test, which was really another interesting group.
What did you do in water test? What's
we
water
were
test?
Water tests, we would actually, we'll check the cars for water leaks. And actually they had an online water test booth, and the cars would actually go through a water, you know, and we had, there was dye in the water, and we had this light, which was a black light, which actually would pick up the dye. I guess even before I got there, people would actually ride the car all the way through looking for leaks. And that must have been like, you know, going through the funhouse. But actually, then they changed the technique with dye, and then as soon as the car would come out of the water test booth, we would open the car, shine our lights, looking for leaks, and if we saw a leak, we would actually repair that leak. And that was a fun job, too, because we were in a small group, and we had our own little world within a world back in the water test booth.
Was that considered just a regular line job, or was that a specialty job?
That was a specialty job. You know, it wasn't a part of quality, even though it was in kind of sort of like an inspection. It wasn't never really technically a part of quality control, but it was controlled by production. But we were checked for leaks, and then if we found a leak, we would repair them.
how was it working? I know you talked about the climate before. How was it working on a water test job on a hot, muggy day?
Well, it was hot, but still, you know, the work was, you know, we were doing like every fourth job or something, and it wasn't as intense as actually being on the line working every job, so it wasn't that hard, but it just took a different kind of skill. You would have to be able to analyze and look and do that particular job and, you know, do it effectively.
Now, I know you said that oftentimes they were small and they were close groups. What was it like to transfer or to go to another area that was a tight-knit group? What was that like, joining that new group, being that new person in that group?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if everybody's familiar with all the group dynamics, and sometimes it was difficult, you know, because they didn't know you, you didn't know them, and it took a while for you to adapt in the group, but eventually, you know, everybody became friends, and, you know, we worked together, and we, like I said, the best part of working at Fisher Body is having these little unique groups where, to deal with the alienation of work, you know, you had your own little world, and you live within that world within the plant, you know, you socialize, you traded skills and knowledge, and you debated the issues of the world. I mean, we just weren't there just building cars. We're human beings, and we were we interacted with one another. We were able to interact on all levels that human beings interact.
So, out of your 30 plus years being there, what was your favorite job?
Well, of course, my last job was being a torque monitor, because that was, as far as work level, that's, you know, considered an easy job or a preferred job. It took me 27 years to get this job, but I actually enjoyed that job because it was challenging. First, we used dial wrenches and this device that we would actually measure the amount of torque on the and all kinds of fasteners, screws, nuts, bolts, and for safety reasons, that information had to be inputted. It took a different kind of skill, and you had to really, you were sort of like, almost like a policeman. You know, you had to police your area. My trim area, I had to make sure all the nuts and bolts and fasteners, everything had the correct torque. And that was a really unique job. And then what's really made it more challenging is that then they went to what they called the Datamite, which was really a handheld computer. And actually, we ended up taught ourselves, you know, once the management had programmed the tool. But we had to go out there and learn how to use this tool. And not only did we learn how to use the tool, we got good at it like everything else. You know, it's just the repetition and everybody's ability to adapt and to take it even further. I mean, we really got good at that stuff.
So, you said you were a little bit like a police officer, and you said that you had your skills that came in. I think it your computer skills came in.
You know, because you're not intimidated. A lot of people would be intimidated by the new technology, and I used to tell them that, I know before I left, this one guy, he was really hesitant about, you know, the job, and I kept telling him over and over again, this is a good job, and if you give this job up, you're crazy, and you'll learn these skills. And the biggest thing, I think, for new hires who come in there who haven't really had any kind of skill level of doing anything is not to be intimidated by these jobs, and these jobs are complex. The public, if they only knew how difficult these jobs are. But if you stick it out and you learn to do it, I mean, it's like your own mind begins to solve all these. I mean, you don't even figure it out. Just your mind, your own intelligence will figure out how to do all this stuff.
Now, with your 30 plus years, and General's had a lot of different programs come through, and naturally you changed jobs while you were there, and they were also different programs that came through. Did you ever get involved in anything? Employee processes that they had, and how do you think that affected us as a business?
Employees' processes, like,
you know, where they had employee involvement. where they started giving employees more hands-on, gave them more responsibility. How did you play in part with any of those?
No, not very, very little. I didn't really get involved in that, but I knew the people. The people who did, and again, I was amazed that they were able to. I mean, really, it's not the engineers who were really building these cars. It's the people out there on that assembly line who were building these cars, and they're the ones who had to look at the pads, the production. I forgot what the pads stand for, but they would give a description of the job and what it took, to do it. But they would, and supervisors didn't even want to deal with. They would hand it to the workers, and people got to understand that those people out there on the line, they solved these problems. They actually got in and built these cars. You know, there wasn't no engineer standing over here telling you what to do. People did it themselves. You know, they figured it out themselves. They look at all the data and stuff, and they analyze the stuff, and they built these cars. You know, of course, the engineers and all these other people were involved, but the people themselves really are the ones who end up building these cars.
Now, I know people, they came together to build cars, but did they also come together for dinners, holidays, benefits? Can you tell us anything about that type of culture? How did they come together like that? Do you remember any benefits or dinners that they had?
I didn't do that too much, but, you know, within the plant, of course, we always, as time went on, and people discover that, you know, they could have a lot of fun by having these little dinners on Friday nights. I mean, at one point in time, people used to go run over to the bar and socialize, but as they began to crack down on that, and it wasn't really a real problem, but still, it became easier for, like, people would come in on Fridays with, you know, just bringing dinners, and we had a good time. We had picnics, and we enjoyed, you know, after, you know, we did our jobs and stuff, and at lunchtime, we would actually socialize. We really had a good, that was fun. I mean, we actually had fun at work, and I don't know if it offends management or not, but, we made it, tolerable. It's an intolerable condition sometimes, but, we enjoyed it when we could.
There's people call Lansing the capital of quality. They call Lansing the capital of quality. What do you attribute that to?
Again, I have to go back to the diversity of the workforce. People took their jobs seriously. They did their job once they understood, and the flexibility to undergo the constant changes. I mean, it takes a lot. When I first hired in there, they may change your job maybe once a year, or if they had to shut the line down, they may add a few things on you, and they would leave you alone. But the ability to adapt, when I left out of there, I mean, they were changing people's jobs about once a month. And the ability to be able to adapt and to keep the quality up, I mean, that was, to me, that's fantastic, and that's a tribute to the workforce.
Okay. Cheryl McCoy?
Milton, we've interviewed a few people, and you had mentioned that you're just, you're having fun. Some of the people we've interviewed have said that they've gotten put in the trunk and sent through water tests. Did you ever see anybody or let anybody out of the trunks, or did you know that happened?
The only time I remember anybody actually being in the truck wheel on offline water tests and were put in the trunk with a flashlight, I don't remember anybody actually in the trunk going through the water test booth. But we, at the end of the line, we had an end-of-the-line water test booth where we would, especially at the beginning of the year, I mean, you would get in the trunk and somebody run a holes and you try to detect where the leak is coming from, but I don't remember anybody actually going to put it in the trunk, no.
Not as a prank?
No. Yeah, if it was a prank, maybe, but not, that wasn't the Fisher policy.
And when you speak of Fisher policy, we know there's a lot of things that are done that are Fisher policy, but we know that there's some folks who... they did things to get through the work, whether it be a prank or maybe if it was radio or read that got them through. Did you notice that? Did you notice a lot of radios or anything like that?
Yeah, because like I said, we weren't human beings. We weren't robots, and you had to have some kind of distraction. Those were long, long days doing repetitious jobs, and if you had a if you had a radio or you had a book to read, or even like when I was going to Michigan State, I actually would write papers in between lines. You know, this is before computers and stuff. You know, you actually had to do the writing, but you know, you took your few seconds to glance, and then you go to your job, and you would think. I mean, it was the work itself became automatic, and then which really, you know. You didn't think about it. I mean, you did it, but your mind was preoccupied with other things. If not, you probably would go crazy.
So that kept you sane, being able to have that.
You always had something going. I mean, people would come in there with manuals and transmissions, and I mean, I thought they were physics techs. People just understand that. To me, the most amazing thing is that the level of understanding, the level of skill in this plant that the general public wouldn't normally associate. I mean, some of those manuals that these guys were bringing in, like I said, they looked like physics textbooks. I mean, they were doing some pretty intense stuff, and they were doing this on their own between cars. I mean, they would look at the stuff.
Now, I know some people had the skilled tradespeople do things like, they call them government jobs. Did you ever have anybody make anything special for you that helped you do any of your jobs?
I'm sure that they made tools and stuff for us. Because when we worked in the door glass, you know, we actually had fixtures and stuff, and they had to be maintained and stuff.
But no special toolboxes or anything like that for you?
Not really, but I knew guys with unskilled trades would make people toolboxes. They would just about do anything for, I remember one time bringing something in there and they were able to repair it, because I didn't have the tools at home, one of the tool men. But like I said, the big thing too was that it served as a resource for, if you didn't know anything or you want to find out how things work, you could always find somebody on that assembly line or in that place that knew how.
Well, you've been in that plant, you've studied there, you've worked there, you've learned things there and had things repaired there. Now, after some 30 plus years, we've gone through a lot of name changes, so what did you think about that? And also, what do you think about now, after you've given 30 plus years there? It's closing now. What do you think about that?
Well, as far as the name change, I always tell anybody, the day when I die, and when they put obituary in the paper, I worked at Fisher Body. I didn't work at BLC or Lansing Car Assembly. I worked at Fisher Body. And as far as the closing, it's sad, even though I know, we all have to move on, but it was a unique way of life, and it's given me a good life. It's given me an education. Traveled the world. I've been to Europe 4 different times. It's been good for me. When things I needed, to enhance my own life and my own home life. Like I said, I used that resource, and people were always there. Whether they came over to your house, which I had a friend was an electrician, come over and do some work for me. I mean, It's other than the paycheck, it was a good life.
Earl Nicholson, is 30 years in the factory, or 30 plus years in the factory, and you're coming up on retirement now. Did you put a signed letter out on the floor, I believe.
Right.
Could you tell us what that's about?
Well, the first part of the letter, I praised, the people I work with, the people who went out of their way to do things for me. And the second part of the letter was a critique against our local 602 union. And I've always been one who, I feel like when you live in a democracy, the leadership you have to make sure that the leaders serve the people. And I think the way our local is structured, that it basically serves the interests of the leadership. And, I can't describe it any better. Maybe I should have brought a copy of it here, but it was my critique against a local 602.
But all in all, would you say that you looked favorable upon the Union and its activities?
Probably maybe at the national level, but I think that the way the locals are structured around personality types, and as much as I praise the workers in the plant, we got so many people who think that they shouldn't have to work, and like I said in my paper, they do anything under the sun to get out of work. And that's the basis of work in the plant, but somehow thinking one is entitled because they belong to a local union or belong to the leadership, I think that's just this anti-union.
Since we talked about unions, would you say that you came in the 60s, in 1967, and when they had activity from the line, from the rank and file, do you think that some of that might have came because the union did so much for them, some of them got separated and didn't stay as active in what was going on in their local union politics? Understanding that the membership is the strongest body of the local union.
No, say that again.
Well, during times when times were lean and we needed the union to help us fight and struggle, but then when people were complacent and happy and they had a lot of benefits, good paychecks, they didn't stay on top or as active. So certain things happened. I mean, certain people staying in power because a lot of people not getting it active.
I don't know, because I don't think the union actually encouraged participation of everybody, even though they give lip service to that. But I don't think they actually encouraged. I think you got a small elite group that was more interested in maintaining their power and privilege at the union hall, and I think they could care less whether people participated. As long as the elitist group, like I said, able to maintain their power and privilege.
Okay. All right. But now, for whatever reason, they're getting ready to start going to a new plant into Delta. What words of wisdom would you like to give to those new people who are going to break ground and start a new venture into a new place of employment?
Well, you know, the auto industry is in, at least the American auto industry is in big trouble. They have to just continue what they're doing, and I think the workers going to have to start, you know, really kind of taking over and really proving to the public that once and for who they are, and that these are the real people who actually build these cars, and that somehow the public got to understand that, you know, nothing is given, you know, we're not given anything. People, when they make this money, they're working hard for this money. This is hard work. This is no game. This is no 15-minute coffee break in every hour. That these people are really working, and now they're working for their own survival. Not only their survival, my survival as a retiree. Because General Motors and Ford, you know, they're going to have to survive, and they're going to have to, and the company really is going to have to be the one that's going to change the perception, and, you know, let Americans know that, you know, that the auto industry is competitive, that we're going to make good products, that we do make good products, but the population somehow think that everything that's made in Asia, for some reason, it's so much superior, you know. But the people are going to have to, they're going to have to take more and more control over the workforce. And they're going to have to make these jobs like real professional jobs. I don't care whether you're sweeping the floor or whatever, you're going to have to, you know, you're a professional. It's what you do.
Okay. Was there anything that we didn't touch on that you'd like to touch on?
Like I said, my ideal of having a diverse workforce. One thing that really bothered me was when they decided to start testing people to get in the plant. In years past, anybody could come into the plant if they were willing to work. And I think by testing, you know, you're getting a homogenous type of worker. I think if they relied on, you know, because you're always going to have people who are going to be able to meet the skill level. I mean, if a guy can't pass an exam, doesn't mean that he can't tear that transmission apart. And to me, that's, you know, I was just totally opposed to that. And you know, and you got to have a diverse workforce, which means if you know, like you had people in that place, like we had lawyers, you had people never even finished high school. Some even went to grade school. But that didn't have anything to do with the, you know, the abilities there. But when you start, you know, think you're going to get a type of particular worker to satisfy somebody's scheme of things, I think that's wrong. I think it's got to continue to stay open and continue to stay diverse.
Well, thank you for sharing.
Okay.
And thank you for being a part of the project.
Thank you.
Thank you, Milton.
Appreciate it.